Canley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New England's no Arizona or California when it comes to sunny weather, but solar power in our region is also taking off, as it is nationwide. Five New England states, including New Hampshire, recently joined forces in what's called the Rooftop Solar Challenge, aimed at making home installations easier and more affordable, and they want a federal grant to bolster their efforts. Meanwhile, the region's independent electric grid operator, ISO New England, has taken note of this sun-powered expansion, and in a recent report says it's re-examining solar and what these gains mean for regional energy needs. At the state level, this fall, Rhode Island flipped the switch on New England's biggest rooftop solar project. Massachusetts was ranked among the top 10 states nationally for its solar capacity. And in New Hampshire, a renewable portfolio standard is encouraging solar development. But while no one's disputing the growth is there, few would also dispute the challenges sun power still faces. It continues to account for a tiny sliver of our energy mix, roughly 1%, and while the cost of photovoltaics has dropped dramatically, regulatory and political obstacles continue to cloud the future of solar energy in our region. Today in The Exchange, are we on the verge of a solar surge? Let's hear from you. Do you see a rise in solar energy here in New Hampshire, or is it still not feasible for most people? Also, how do you think solar fits in or stacks up against other renewable energies? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Keep them short. Or send us a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests. Joining us from New York City is Ken Wells, editor-at-large and senior writer for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Businessweek. He covers energy issues. You can find a link to his work on our webpage, nhpr.org. Ken Wells, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Also with us, Clay Mitchell, directing partner at Revolution Energy Company based in Portsmouth. He holds a doctorate in natural resources and environmental science from UNH. And Clay Mitchell, good to have you. Thank you very much for being here as well.
Thank you.
And Jack Ruderman is also with us, director of the Sustainable Energy Division at the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission. And Jack, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you, Laura.
Well, all of you, but I'm going to start with you first, Jack. Boy, lots of enthusiastic headlines these days about the growth in solar power. Jack, how much is it growing in our region here in New England?
It's growing by leaps and bounds. You know, we're in the midst of a huge surge, particularly in some other states like Massachusetts, as you noted in your intro, where they've just got a tremendous amount of systems installed in the last 5 years. But we're also seeing it in New Hampshire on a smaller and more modest scale. When we first started doing consumer rebate programs here, so for the average homeowner, if you want to put some panels on your roof, you can get a rebate through the Public Utilities Commission. There were probably 100 systems, 150 residential systems in the state. Since July 2009, we've had about 1,200 rebate applications. So, you know, you're talking about an increase in the order of about 1,000%. And we're also running rebate programs for businesses, and we're seeing a huge surge of interest there as well. So it's all relative. We're not doing as well as some other New England states. But compared to where we were a few years ago, we've really made some substantial progress.
Clay Mitchell, I've heard others say what Jack says. Solar has grown by leaps and bounds. Still, when you account for such a teeny, teeny slice of the energy pie, it's easy to grow by leaps and bounds, right? I mean, there's a perspective there.
Yeah, and you got to start somewhere. And I mean, just like the whole world wasn't powered by electricity at one point, you had to start somewhere small and you grow as the economics and the technology supports it. And that's what we're in the midst of.
How do you see the growth?
I see the growth as I would like to see it managed so that we can address some of the concerns that people have raised and take the time to allow for market transformation. The key here is not so much the technology, but it's a combination of the financing that needs to take place. We need to develop a market that supports the financing, and then we also need to allow for market transformation to take place. More people to come on. We need installers to learn how to bring their prices down, manufacturers, technologies. It's time to let the change happen so that the market develops appropriately.
Okay, and I may want to pick up a little bit more on what you mean by it needs to be managed. But from what I understand, Ken Wells, the prices have gone down tremendously in recent years, right? That was the big stumbling block years ago.
It's astonishing. There's been a 62% drop in the cost of photovoltaic panels.
62%.
Yeah, this is since 2010, probably 80% since 2008. And then the what's called the soft cost, which are the installation costs, are dropping at about 15% a year. So it's been really sort of a radical shift in the cost structure. And, of course, it's showing in the numbers.
And you've been reporting on this, Ken. And one of the headlines of a story that you wrote was, it said, solar energy is ready, the U.S. isn't. And you quoted someone saying, Ken, economically and technologically, the game is over. The hang-ups are strictly political. So what are you saying there?
Well, I mean, look, they're selling solar panels at IKEA these days. We wrote a story about microgrids, which are sort of, you know, the ability of residential customers now, if they want to basically become their own utility systems. So in terms of the technology, I mean, it's almost like plug and play now when you think about how easy it is to do. A dozen years ago, if you wanted to get off the grid, you needed an electrical engineer. Now you can kind of go to Home Depot, and if you know what you're doing, you could probably do that. Most people don't want to get off the grid, but this is where we've come to in terms of the technology.
Wow, plug-and-play solar.
Getting close to that.
Well, and you said homeowners are, because of these advances, Ken, sort of becoming, if they want, their own little utility there. What sort of challenges does that present for the utility industry?
Well, think about this. 90,000 residential and small businesses adopted rooftop solar in 2012. We think the number at the end of this year will be another 100,000. California already has more than 600,000 homes on that, on rooftop residential solar. If you start doing the math on that, someone is losing out, and that would be the utilities, which are, we have kind of this 100-year-old regulated model in which, these utilities have long-term fixed costs and they sell bonds to, over 30 years. And suddenly the energy production paradigm is shifting on them. And again, as we say, solar is small at the moment, but when they look down the road, they can see kind of a tsunami coming at them. And the real fear is that, this is going to, in the long term, sort of hollow out that revenue stream, causing them to raise rates, and as they raise rates, more people will go off and get solar, and it will be sort of this death spiral.
Ah.
So that's the great fear.
So sort of an unvirtuous cycle, so to speak.
Right.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then I have a lot more questions for all of you. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation on solar energy, where we are at with this today, especially here in New Hampshire and New England, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. All one word. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Jack Rudiman, what do you think about what Ken Wells says? Solar not quite fitting in that traditional way in how we've always produced and delivered energy in the past. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Laura. The analogy a lot of people like to make is, back in the 70s or 80s, when you looked at the computer industry, we had these huge mainframe computers that cost millions and millions of dollars. And then along came the PC, and it just turned everything upside down, and we decentralized. And that's what people are talking about now. We have these central power plants, some of which burn fuels in a very, very inefficient manner. Maybe they're 30% efficient. And then when you transmit the power over the lines, you lose another 3 to 5 or 7%. So it's a very inefficient way of delivering power to the home. And now you have, as Ken referred to it, these systems that are practically plug and play. I would add, you do need an electrician to hook them up, and you ought to be careful about that. But once they're hooked up, they integrate into your home seamlessly, and they're maintenance free. And they produce results for, 25, 30 years, et cetera. So I think we're beginning to see this decentralization. And it's not just solar. There's a general term for it, which is called distributed generation. And so people may be installing wind turbines or other forms of renewable electricity at their home or at their business, which makes them less reliant on utilities. Not completely unreliant. Most people still want to stay plugged into that grid because they need the reliability and the consistency and stability of supply. But it definitely is, in the long term, a shift away from centralized power plants.
And so what do you do for those centralized power plants who people still want to be there so that they can be absolutely sure the lights go on?
Sure. That's a tough question, and I'm going to let Clay jump in because it looks like he's got a thought.
Thanks, Jack. when I talked about the managing of the growth, this plays into that.
Right.
And I think what Ken was talking about is by managing, I think that the policy needs to catch up with what we're talking about here. It's a perversion the way we pay the utility based on the amount of power they produce, and we turn around and tell them to save and be efficient. And that's got to stop. We've got to reward them for providing the grid and having these central power plants to back us up and encourage them to support the innovation that's going on. That is not what is happening today. And so the utilities are structured to oppose this because of exactly what Ken said. And what we need to do is, instead of this kind of battling and adversity, we need to sit around and figure out what the solutions are and all work together and get the utilities the money they need to survive and allow us to diversify our grid sources. It's that simple, but nobody can see through the politics because everybody's so entrenched in that battle stage.
Well, and here's an email that came in before the show to that point, Clay. This is from Beth in Canterbury. Now, she made a couple points. Beth, I'm just going to take two for the moment. She says, most of us don't want an industrial power facility in our backyard, be it a coal mine or a coal plant, 500-foot-tall windmills, acres of solar or hydro. Distributed energy production and energy conservation at every level, Beth says, will reduce the need for these industrial producers in our personal neighborhoods. That's one of her points, and that seems to be what you're getting at there, Clay.
It is, and it's also there's some to kind of weave it back into the financing mode. These things should be put on a house when it's built. Not you build a house and then you have to put the thing on later. We cut the cost by 20% just by doing that. And you wrap it into the home mortgage, it's guaranteed to be cash positive on day one. So every day you don't use solar, you're losing money. And this whole, fabrication about the return on investment evaporates in 2 seconds.
Although a lot of the housing stock, as you know, is old
right.
here in New England.
Well, and that's right. But still, we're building houses at a phenomenal rate, and we're going to come back. We've gone through two dramatic periods of growth. We're going to go through another one. So why don't we get prepped up and do it right the first time.
Okay, and Beth had another question that I'm going to ask you guys after a super short break. And we'll take your phone calls as well, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Send us a short email to exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You're invited to join the Walter Peterson Legacy Society by including NHPR in your estate plan. When you do, you'll help ensure our on-air service to the New Hampshire community for years to come. More information about the Walter Peterson Legacy Society and our many planned giving options is at nhpr.org. New Hampshire weather, winter weather advisory in effect for most of the state till midnight tonight. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Froling Energy, providing and installing high-efficiency wood pellet boilers for commercial, institutional, and residential space heating, online at frolingenergy.com. From Ansel & Anderson Trust and Estate Attorneys in Bedford, providing estate planning tailored to blended or unconventional families, on the web at anselpa.com. And Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, presenting the 12 Days of Christmas with over 100 young performers from New Hampshire, December 13th at 7, December 14th at 2, ccanh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, growth and development, as well as challenges for solar power here in New England. We want to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see a rise in solar energy here in New Hampshire, or is it still not feasible for most people? Also, how do you see solar energy comparing to other renewable energies for us here in the Granite State? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Keep them short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, just before the break, I was reading a comment from Beth in Canterbury. And here's another point that she makes, and I'll throw this to you, Ken Wells. She says, I often hear the media pitting one renewable source against another, but we need a mix of renewable energy sources for a resilient energy system. I'd love your thoughts on that too, Ken.
Well, no, I think that's true. I mean, I think we need to, have a diversified energy policy, period. In fact, it would be nice to have a national energy policy. When you think of the nations that do, to me, the surprise statistic in solar, worldwide, is that the leader in rooftop solar installation in the world is Germany.
Not a sunny place.
And it's same latitude as Maine, with about as many sunny days as Seattle. You know, so it's, I mean, the idea that somehow you have to be in California to make this work is just not true.
Well,
but she's right. We need a variety of sources.
Can you clear something up for us, Ken, since you just hit on it? You know, there is still a concern that what do you do when the sun doesn't shine? How do you store solar energy when the sun is shining and you need to save it for a rainy day, so to speak? Can you just explain that?
Well, the way it works now is that's why most people want to stay connected to the grid, even though you have solar, because essentially the grid is your backup on those days when it doesn't work. However, the revolutionary technology that might be 5 years away would be a substantial increase in battery storage, because that is sort of the keystone. The people who really want to get off the grid are looking for sort of a fivefold increase in the ability of current battery technology to store stuff. And once that happens, then essentially you could, if you wanted to, sort of live grid-free. So, and I think for a lot of people who totally want to get off the grid, you know, that's the holy grail. And, of course, that is utility's worst nightmare.
So how long can a solar battery, the best solar battery, can hold power for right now? You know, 2 days, 5 days, a month?
You know, I mean, I will use the electric car analogy, you know, where the Tesla gets, 70 miles, 90 miles, when it needs to get 300 miles on a charge. And I think that's the issue with solar battery, backup battery technology in general now. We just don't have the capacity yet that we need. So,
what do you think, Jack?
I think that's true. And, you know, there's no perfect technology. And it may be that with PV or photovoltaics, you know, our code for solar electric here, you know, storage may be a tough nut to crack. But it's important to remember that it's one of a range of technologies that you can use. And we're not even talking about, you know, probably the biggest energy need of a home in New England, which is heating. And that's a whole other show, of course. But, you know, wood pellet heating systems, wood chip heating systems are going to help us reduce our reliance on, you know, heating fuels, propane, you know, imported fossil fuels, et cetera. So I think you have to look at the whole picture and say solar is one very important piece of it, but it's not going to solve all of our needs.
All right. Again, Beth, thank you very much for that email. And let's go to our callers. Dennis is waiting in Gorham. Hi, Dennis. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'd like to know what is being done to get the incentives in line with adjacent states. Vermont has feed-in tariffs to encourage PV. Massachusetts is paying $250 for an equivalent quantity. And there currently appears to be no incentive in New Hampshire to generate solar. The alternate compliance payment used to be $168. Now it's $55. And I think that's somewhat tied to the SREC pricing.
So this is something you're definitely interested in, Dennis, it sounds like, but the costs are a concern.
Well, I've had solar since 92.
Oh, wow.
So I guess I'm one of the pioneers, and I'm just looking into SRECs now because previously the paperwork was, I think, even more complex than it is now.
Okay, so, and you said SRX. Okay.
SREC, which is essentially every megawatt hour of power you produce, there's a value out there in the market that, let's say, if you go to Starbucks or any place, they'll say, we're a green power producer. Frequently, they don't have a power plant in their backyard. They're just buying these SRECs, and that says that they've bought renewable attributes equal to the amount of power they use.
Okay. Dennis, thanks a lot for calling. Clay, I'm going to throw that to you.
So the question was basically what is being done to align our incentives with other states?
He seems to be saying other New England states are doing a better job than New Hampshire.
I think they're doing a different job. I think New Hampshire is still learning. And it is true that the precipitous drop in the alternative compliance payment was a little bit unfortunate. And there's two issues with that. One, it's a drop. So it caps the SRAC at a value that's $200 below what's currently trading for a Massachusetts system in Massachusetts. But what's more troubling about that kind of behavior is that financing markets need to look at a state for investing, and they look at it state by state because the policy is set at the state level. So if you're jumping around with your policies and not sending a clear indication that we're a secure place to invest, guess what? People aren't going to invest. And then you have this self-fulfilling prophecy of saying, well, nobody's investing in solar. Particularly, we see that at the political realm, and then we go back and say, well, you guys are monkeying with all these incentives. Mm. What bank is going to invest in what it views to be an unsafe environment? And so people need to relax a little and get together and go back. I'm going to, by the end of this, you're going to be tired of me saying this, but we need to talk about solutions, and people need to sit down and understand that this is a financial market we're talking about as well as a technology.
So let me interrupt you for just a second and clarify something. So you're saying that the incentives state by state are vastly different, as we've heard, and that New Hampshire is not doing a great job with these incentives? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. I was addressing the disparity between the SREC prices. On the other hand, New Hampshire has a rebate, which is an upfront money, which really helps finance systems. For residential level scale, I think the New Hampshire program is the best.
Okay. And Ken Wells, I want to ask you something too. And Jack, I can see you want to jump in. Nationally, Ken, okay, what's the conversation about why state governments should give people tax credits or rebates or whatever? I mean, is there an argument going on, Ken, again, around the country that, you know, look, solar should do this on its own. Why should taxpayer dollars go to subsidizing this?
Well, okay. I mean, this is essentially a political issue. And my view based on my reporting is that the political will in the country, in the main, in most places, is toward green renewable energy to, you know, lessen our use of fossil fuels, imported oil. And so there is an interest in, you know, weaning ourselves from these things. And one way to do that is to incentivize renewable power, including solar. You know, the other side of that argument is that, you know, the utilities are saying, you know, gee, what this really amounts to is a subsidy for the rich people who can afford to put solar on their roof, and, you know, the people who can't afford to do that are now being left to sort of pick up the tab for that.
Through their taxes.
Right. Well, or through their utility bills. But I don't know, when you have, you know, the giant utility industry lobbyists sort of arguing about social equity on behalf of poor people, you know, which is not necessarily a stand that they've always taken, then you know that there's some shift going on in the politics, because this is sort of a, you know, it's an interesting argument for them to make, but I'm not sure it's ringing true in a lot of places.
You know, Ken, Clay has brought up, again, private markets, banks, investing and so forth. Why isn't private sector financing enough to get solar really off the ground? Why do we need state subsidies or federal subsidies?
Well, again, you know, because there's certainly, you know, I mean, basically, you know, I think solar is now at parity, you know, that is with conventional grid prices in only 3 states. It may achieve parity in 11 states in the next 5 years, and then half the states probably by 2020. But at the moment, it's still more expensive than than conventional forms of power. So if you're going to spread it around, then you have to have a way of, you know, incentivizing. And I think that's what they've been doing. On the other hand, you know, there are some interesting private sector solutions. There's a company we wrote about called Gen 110 out in California, which has a leasing model. Essentially, they'll come in and put solar on your roof for nothing, no capital cost, no outlay on your part, no cash down. And essentially what they do is they aggregate all the solar power that they produce from all these roofs and sell them back to the consumer at prices about 10 to 30% less than grid power. And of course, this is only possible in states that have very high grid power costs, like California, Nevada, Hawaii, Arizona. But, you know, that's a model that's been very successful so far.
Jack Ruderman, I know you want to jump in on this point.
Yeah, actually, I want to go back to what Clay was saying about the difference in incentive levels between the states. And I want to say that I think, and to my earlier comments that, you know, we're growing by leaps and bounds here. That is all true, but I want to highlight that we have a law in New Hampshire called the Renewable Portfolio Standard Law, which requires utilities and competitive electricity suppliers to acquire certain percentages of their power from green sources, including solar. And each year, those requirements crank up. And so far, we've been pretty successful in meeting those requirements. But as the requirements for solar crank up higher and higher each year, we are facing a situation where even though we have a lot of residential and small to medium commercial systems, we are not getting the utility scale systems that we're seeing in other states. So, for instance, in Massachusetts, you're seeing installations going in at, you know, 5 megawatts or 7 megawatts, which is a pretty enormous installation. A megawatt can generally power 500 to 1,000 homes. In New Hampshire, our biggest system is 500 kilowatts, and that's an ARRA-funded system on top of the airport in Manchester. And so moving forward, we may have an issue with incentive levels and the fact that we're not competitive with other states. And we recently had a developer from New Jersey come up and testify in front of the legislature, in front of a renewable portfolio standard committee, and say, I'm not doing business in New Hampshire, and I'm not going to do business in New Hampshire because you don't have adequate incentives. You've got to boost the incentives. So there's a real tension because justifiably the legislature is concerned about the rate impacts, and they don't want to just write a blank check and say, everybody come and do business in New Hampshire. We're offering these extremely generous incentives.
Well, and typically New Hampshire doesn't do that.
Exactly. We're doing it the New Hampshire way, and it's working so far. But I just want to highlight that moving forward, we may have to reexamine the issue of whether the incentive levels are at the appropriate levels.
Okay. And I want to go back to our listeners. But, Jack, I do have to ask you, you know, you said down the road, utility scale folks may not want to come in here and develop solar because of the incentive structure. But Beth, our emailer earlier said, and we talked about solar, people don't want industrial size facilities in their backyards, whether it's coal or solar. Maybe solar is different. Maybe solar really is, you know, person by person instead of big mega facilities producing megawatts. Maybe that's not what solar is meant for.
Well,
especially here in New England.
Sure, sure. Although, you know, recognize that a big solar plant can be covering the entire roof of a large scale box store. Or you could be, you know, redeveloping a, you know, what they call a brownfield at a town where they used to have a wastewater treatment facility, and now they've got all this land, and it wouldn't take much to cover it with panels. And you're not really talking about, you know, a 400-foot wind tower or something with a smokestack.
Cutting down a bunch of trees. I see. So you could put it on top of your local Walmart.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to develop larger-scale systems.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's a great Facebook comment that came in from Victor, and it's very appropriate for today. I'm going to throw it to you, Clay Mitchell. With rooftop panels, Victor asks, does one have to clear snow from them every time it snows? Seems like an issue with multi-story homes.
No.
You don't have to clear the snow?
Not every time. The snow melts, and in most cases, in a light snow, the panels will heat up a little bit and shed the snow on a fairly quick basis. You do want to make sure that you design the installation so that it can do that. And just if you in we're seeing new technologies with racking equipment that lightens the load on the roof, so you don't have to have an increased concern about loads on the roof. Just like Jack said about the electrical portion of an array, you also have to be careful about the structural capabilities of the roof. We use a racking system from
What's a racking system?
It's what you mount the panels to.
Okay.
We did an install over at Favorite Foods, and we used a plastic racking system manufactured in Ohio, all recycled plastic. It just fits together like an Erector set, and it adds virtually no weight. You can pick up a stack of 10 or 12 of these racks that hold the panels. We actually have to weigh them down with bricks because they're so light.
Oh, you don't want them to fly off the roof on a windy day.
That's right. Yeah. And so there are new technologies coming out. The snow will melt. If you don't want to design it so it ends up capturing snow and making a problem, but the change of your behavior would be governed by a structural engineer, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah, Ken, to you, what other sort of technical concerns have come up with photovoltaics?
Well, you know, there have been some big fights out in California with these industrial-scale solar plants that have been put on the public desert. And there are a lot of habitat groups out there who are saying what a lot of people are saying, we should not be taking the unspoiled desert to build industrial-scale solar. On the other hand, there are plenty of places in the desert, you know, utility corridors, old mine sites, where, in fact, you could put these industrial-scale plants without, you know, any environmental impact or very little. But, that, you know, there's been litigation and all manner of fights out there over that very issue.
So these industrial scale solar facilities, probably wouldn't see this in New England, but I think I read about one, correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, in the Mojave Desert, you know, miles and miles of solar panels, and people are upset about the impact on the ecosystem. Is that right?
Well, you know, that this plant that just went online, Ivanpah, which is going to generate enough solar power to power 140,000 homes. But the big issue is that there's a rare species out there called the desert tortoise, and the original environmental impact statement said that there would be very few, and then they started digging up hundreds of them as they began to prepare the site, and it sort of turned into a fiasco in which the builder, the developer, had to spend something like $56 million on tortoise relocation efforts. And that sort of, raised a lot of eyebrows. That, should we be doing this, in places where, there are all these other environmental values. It's a tough call.
Let's take another call if we could. Jeffrey's joining us from Andover. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for calling in. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. I just was listening to the conversation and have a few objections or some different thoughts on what was being mentioned about larger utility scales and how the state of New Hampshire might want to support that. I'd like to point out that, first off, that your panelists are entirely correct. There is a need for decentralized power of all sorts, and there's definitely a need for adjustment in our regulations here on the state scale. However, it needs to be mentioned, I think, that that solar power, particularly when you get into the larger farms, which I actually have some personal experience with doing financing of renewables for the last 25 years, they're still only producing power at the daytime, and it's still a very dirty power. It's power that needs to be conditioned, and certain utilities have seen issues of integrating that power into the grid. But again, that's a discussion for another day. Really, the point is, I think New Hampshire is right not to provide any kind of a subsidy or support, for utility-sized projects, because I think the experience around the world is that these really are not financially viable. They're politically convenient. People like them because they're new and shiny. But Spain, Germany, England are all backing away from their large farms. Thailand recently, which had a massive program of build-out, has realized that, again, the power is dirty, hard to deal with. There's a 30% increase in their cost in putting that power on the grid, and they pulled away from that program. So I don't think that really farm-level solar farm-level systems are appropriate for New Hampshire, particularly here, and this is where I'll end my comment, is that we do need decentralized power. There are a lot of solutions out there. We have more wood than we know what to do with, and properly managed, biomass has been shown to be a very stable 24-hour-a-day power source that we have, and that can be done cleanly and very much in decentralized projects. I've been involved in biomass power from 20-kilowatt systems right up through to 22-megawatt systems, all running successfully for over 10 years now. So I think there
Jeffrey,
needs to be
great
a change
points.
In focus.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but great points. We're going to pick up after a short break. And we have looked at biomass on this program in the past and definitely will in the future. So I appreciate that point, especially here in New Hampshire. We've got a lot of trees. We'll follow up after a short break, Jeffrey. So thanks for calling in. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the push to raise the nation's minimum wage, then football's impact on America, and why the game needs reform. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, winter weather advisory in effect for most of the state till midnight tonight. A mix of snow, freezing rain, and rain for today. Total snow accumulations from 1 to 3 inches most of the state, 2 to 4 inches in the North Country. Highs today, upper 20s to mid 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and New Hampshire liquor and wine outlets offering holiday gift-giving ideas of wine and spirits, including a selection of more than 7,000 wines in 77 stores located throughout New Hampshire. And Conway Scenic Railroad celebrating the holidays with Santa trains on weekends and December 23rd and daily train excursions Christmas Vacation Week, conwayscenic.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, New Hampshire Catholics reflect on their new pope. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at the expansion of solar power, new technologies, new capabilities, and some ongoing challenges. Join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. PR. With me in studio, Clay Mitchell, directing partner at Revolution Energy Company, Jack Ruderman, director of the Sustainable Energy Division at the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, and Ken Wells, editor-at-large and senior writer for Bloomberg News. He covers energy issues. And Ken, to you first, please, what did you make of Jeffrey's call just before the break saying, you know, New Hampshire is right not to subsidize utility-sized solar projects? He said Spain, Germany, England are pulling out of these projects.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, just to give you the example of what we did, in 2009, I think the Obama administration threw something like $9 billion in stimulus money at mostly large-scale solar projects out in the Western desert. Many of those are being built out and are about to go online. But I think, you know, we were just doing some reporting around that, and I think there's beginning to be sort of a rethinking of that model, because, you know, there are all kinds of issues with getting transmission lines to some of these things, the environmental impact on the ground there, and the fact that, you know, we have other alternatives. So, you know, there's kind of this inherent conflict between the rooftop people, kind of the distributed generation people, and the big utilities about how we ought to be doing this thing. And it kind of goes to the point that why not use, you know, the rights of ways of every freeway in America and hang solar on that, as opposed to going up and disturbing, you know, pristine areas of wilderness to do it. And so, you know, that's you know, I think we're beginning to see that debate even happen here. On the other hand, you know, there are people who say, look, we need everything we can get. We need all our weapons if we're really going to, you know, make a dent in fossil fuel use and have some hope of, you know, stemming warming. So it's a complicated issue.
Yeah, sure is. And at least here in New Hampshire, Jack Ruderman, we're not really talking about destroying pristine wilderness to install large solar projects.
No, that's exactly
right. Might be the case out in the deserts of Arizona, but
that's exactly right. You know, the scale of those projects in the deserts out in the Southwest is, you know, probably 10 to 20 times the size of anything you would see in New Hampshire. What we're talking about here are pretty modest and reasonable projects that I don't think anybody's going to get too upset about having in their backyard.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in, Clay?
Well, I think one of a couple of the other issues are is that I agree with Jack, and it's that these systems can be used to stabilize the grid, actually, and we're seeing that down in the PJM ISO, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland. They're actually using these small
ISO again is the electric grid operator,
right? And so they're rewarding folks who are putting up solar arrays and using small battery banks and specialized inverters, which is the device that actually connects the array to the grid, and they're using that to manage the harmonics and the distortion on the grid. They're actually using the solar array as a stabilizing factor in you know, so the concept that these medium-sized systems are destabilizing is just not true.
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
I want to add one other point. We haven't talked about this one attribute of solar, which is really important, which is solar helps us bring down costs when the power grid is straining under heavy demand. So during the summer months, for instance, when you're in the middle of a heat wave, the biggest demand is in the afternoon. And
people crank up their air conditioners.
Exactly. And solar is said to be peak coincident, which means it is usually cranking out the most power at a time precisely when all of a sudden we are powering up some ancient, dirty, very, very expensive power plants. And so one of the really main advantages of solar power is that it helps bring down costs, not just for the homeowner, but for all of us, because it helps reduce the amount of power we have to draw off the grid precisely when grid prices are sometimes up by a factor of 10.
Well, this gets to partly to Jeffrey, our caller's point, saying that perhaps biomass is a better source for New Hampshire. He said people like solar because it's shiny and new, but it doesn't work for everybody. We had a caller who couldn't stay on who had a similar thought. This person said hydro and geothermal might be better for New England. This person said the weather isn't as good for solar here in this region. What do you think, Ken Wells? Again, for New England, for the Northeast, is solar a better option, or should we be looking more at bio, hydro, geothermal? It's this whole balance issue.
Well, you know, again, I think you have to deploy all your weapons. I think most people who look at the whole shifting energy paradigm realize that we really need a mix of choices. But I think the larger point is that, you know, for the first time ever, the power is flowing both ways. You know, the grid was designed for power to flow one way, and now with solar and distributed generation, you know, the power is flowing both ways. And that's not going back. I mean, as much as the utilities have started to sort of rebel and bark at that, it seems to me that that is the paradigm shift that we're about to engage in. And I think that's inevitable. And, it's sort of like the mileage standards for cars when the federal government first proposed them in 1974. You know, GM went out and hired 1,000 lawyers to figure out how to beat them, and Toyota hired 1,000 engineers to figure out how to meet them, you know. And I think this is where the utility industry stands today. It can either get on the bus and figure out how to harness this innovation, or it can sort of stand there and be a bystander to this paradigm shift, which I think eventually is going to overcome it. So
let's take another call if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Charlie's waiting in Peterborough. Hi, Charlie. Thanks for hanging on.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of have a two-part question. My first question is, how long do the batteries actually last that they hold the cells for their lifetime? And then what do you do with them after their lifetime, their carbon footprint? What happens to the batteries after?
Yeah, good question. Thanks a lot, Charlie, for calling in. Clay, how about you?
With some of the ones that we're using, they're sealed lead glass mat batteries, and they're zero maintenance. The warranties are anywhere from 15 to 20 years, and you recycle them. There's a pretty aggressive market for recycling batteries. I mean, nobody should ever throw away a car battery. You can take it back to the place where you buy a new one.
So not as big a concern as you might have. We've all heard about don't put your battery in a landfill, for
example. Yeah, you definitely don't want to do that. But and this is the technology that I think is going to be the most exciting coming down the line, new storage techniques.
Thank you for the call, Charlie. Lots of emails have come in. I want to share a couple of them with you. This is Glenn in Deerfield. He says, as a preface to my question, I considered getting rooftop solar power installed on my house. I decided against it when I found out how much trouble it was to connect and integrate the panels to my grid-based power. Glenn says, with net metering, why not connect my solar panels to the grid directly and get credit for the power they contribute to the grid without integrating it into my home grid-based power? Ken, I know you've written about that. People creating solar power on their property and selling it to the grid, basically. The net metering, I think that's what it's called. Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Well, essentially, you get a credit is what you, I think, how most net metering systems work. It's sort of a deduct based upon the amount of solar power that you have produced against your electricity bill. The technical challenges, we were writing about these things called microgrids, essentially, which are allowing, homeowners or small businesses to basically become their own utilities if they choose to. It allows you to kind of self-generate a lot of your own power and manage it in the same way that utilities have, with the sophistication that utilities have been able to manage it. But, these are sort of more expensive systems for people who are probably early adopters. But the point of that is that they're probably only 5 to 10 years away from essentially being plug and play. And at that point, and I think a lot of people, we're in the process of writing a story about Hawaii, which has the highest grid power rates in the nation, something like 35 to 37 cents a kilowatt hour as compared to 7 cents for the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Wow.
And everybody who can is trying to get off grid power and onto solar power. And it's causing a complete sort of dislocation in the utility structure there. And they're having to put people off. We can't connect now. We're not sure how this is going to, we're fearing that this new surge of power is going to destabilize the grid. And so now there are a lot of people in Hawaii who are actively seeking out better battery storage technology so they can actually get off the grid and be done with their power company. Now that's, that's sort of avant-garde and an extreme situation. But, down the road, you can kind of see that this technology at some point will be ripe and more people may decide to do that.
Jack Ruderman, do we have net metering here in New Hampshire where if I'm creating, I'm just throwing out numbers here, 10 megawatts of power at my house and I only need 5, I can sell the rest of it to Unitil, which is the utility here in Concord. Do we have that now?
We do, and we've had it for quite some time. The law establishing that goes back probably 10 years. And of the 1,200 systems that I mentioned recently that we've done, residential systems, in the last 3.5 years, I would venture to say almost every one of them is net metered. So what happens is as you are producing power, you're offsetting your import from the grid. And if you're actually producing more power than you're using, you are literally spinning your meter backwards, and you are getting a credit on your bill. which after a true-up period of roughly a year, if you're over a certain amount of credits, you can actually cash that in with your utility. So we have net metering, and it plays an important role, as I alluded to earlier, in relieving the strain on the power grid when the power is most needed.
So our emailer's question, Glenn in Deerfield, says, why not connect my solar panels to the grid directly and get credit for the power they contribute without integrating it into my home grid-based power? So why even have that middle step there? What do you think, Jack? Is that feasible, or Clay?
It's feasible, but it's not how our laws are set up. And it's odd to me that you can't – it should be very easy to connect a solar array. The technology that has become almost, you know, mind-blowing in its complexity and sophistication is the inverter device. And that will allow you to connect to a 20-amp breaker if you have a standard-sized residential system. It should just be wired right in, and you should never have a problem.
Well, here's a question from Sarah Jane. She's got a question for you, Ken Wells. She says, how can we encourage regional banks to lend on small commercial systems? Also, you mentioned the cost of solar has decreased significantly, but it's still challenging to finance solar without the cash benefits of tax credits. Again, her Facebook comment closes by saying, how can we encourage the local investment market to pay attention to solar tax credits? Ken, that gets into that sort of public-private financing issue that we talked about earlier. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, the real issue is that, right, all of this stuff varies state by state. And so some states are generous and have, you know, do in fact create incentives for private lenders to get into the game, and other states don't have these incentives, which is, you know, another argument to actually come up one day with a national energy policy in which we would be able to harmonize all this stuff across all of the states so that everyone would be on the same page. I mean, this is, to some extent, this is why Germany was able to do what it did, because it has a national solar power. There's one set of rules for everybody in the nation, and everyone follows them. So I think that's the problem. I don't know enough about the situation on the ground where you are to say whether, you know, what that would take. But I think the real issue is that there's no one set of standards, and if we had one set of standards, we could get a lot more of the stuff done.
Yeah, I'm getting a sense from you, Ken, and from our other guests that it really does vary a lot state by state.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Well, and is Germany a reasonable model, Ken, to look at in terms of that, given, you know, it's a very different culture, political system, and so forth? I mean, I don't know if we'd ever be like Germany, even though some solar advocates would like us to be.
No, I think that's a good point. I think I use Germany, though, as sort of, you know, the realm of the possible. I mean, here's a sort of country on a northern sort of latitude that has, you know, gone way out of its way to make this happen. And like there was a day in May, a sunny day in May, for a couple of hours in which the rooftop solar panels in Germany supplied all the power of the nation, you know, for a couple of hours. And, you know, which is a startling and sort of revolutionary thing. So I think the ideal of Germany is to say, you know, solar can work in a lot of places, and it's not just California and the sunny states. But yes, they certainly do have a different structure. But it does make the argument that, you know, could we do a better job of sort of harmonizing, you know, these requirements across the state so that, you know, we're all on the same page.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like that saying, the realm of the possible. Ken, just real quick to you and then to our guests in studio, what do you think is going to happen in terms of this realm of the possible, Ken? How much do you think you'll see solar power take off in this country?
Well, look, commercial power prices have gone up by a third since 2003. Solar panel prices have dropped 62% since 2010. We use the data of a research firm called Navigant that said solar is expected to reach parity, has already reached parity with unsubsidized grid prices in most of the world already. So it seems to me that there's kind of an inevitability about solar, because when you think about fossil fuels, extraction costs almost always go up. But with solar, you know, once you have the system in place, you know, the power is free. So, you know, long term, I'm not quite sure, but I think it's going to be at some point a substantial contributor to our energy mix.
Jack Ruderman, what do you think? This convergence that Ken talks about is energy prices go up and the price of installation and photovoltaics goes down.
I think that's exactly right. And financing, as we've talked about several times during the show, is one of the keys. And one thing I wanted to mention briefly, if I could, is there are already unique financing arrangements in place, and Clay's company and others in New Hampshire use this, where towns and universities or businesses can get these panels installed at zero upfront costs. I want to emphasize that, no upfront costs. So the installer pays for the equipment. The installer then gets to take advantage of a 30% federal investment tax credit, accelerated depreciation, the market for RECs, et cetera. The site, the university, the town hall, whoever, they agree to buy the power, and they get to lock in that power probably at a slightly below market rate for a contract of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. So there are some unique mechanisms in place that are working, and that's where we're starting to see the development of some of the bigger systems in New Hampshire. So I want to say the future is in what these are called power purchase agreement financing arrangements.
Wow. Are you saying that if I'm the head of, you know, some small town, board of selectmen, I can get a free solar installation in all my town buildings?
It's not free because you'll be paying for the power for
right,
20
but
years,
stuff.
But you will have zero capital upfront costs. And I think Clay can tell you about a system in Exeter that they did, for instance.
Yeah. So just broadly, Clay, if you could, where do you think we're going with this? If you come back in 5 years, what are we going to say?
We're going to talk about a lot more solar being on the ground because somebody will have stepped up to fill the leadership gap that we have and got everybody to sit around and talk about what our solutions are. And the technology and the financing has caught up with this policy goal that we've set. And I think that's the biggest problem is the leadership.
Okay. Clay, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. You're the best.
Clay Mitchell, directing partner at Revolution Energy Company based in Portsmouth. Ken Wells, good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
Ken Wells, editor-at-large and senior writer for Bloomberg News. You can find a link to some of his work on our webpage, nhpr.org. Jack Ruderman, good to see you. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, you as well, Laura.
Jack Ruderman, director of the Sustainable Energy Program at the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our intern is Nate Graby. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, has the new Pope brought new hope to Granite State Catholics? Ever since Pope Francis was chosen to lead the Church, his words and actions have generated discussion around dinner tables and made headlines around the world. Some feel this people's Pope has re-energized the Church, but others worry he's de-emphasizing important issues and traditional doctrines. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
New Hampshire Public Radio, 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Small Dog Electronics, offering Dr. Small Dog house calls for home and business, Mac and PC technical service and repair. Online at smalldog.com/doctor. And Cedar Crest Center for Children with Disabilities, comprehensive medical care and education for children with complex medical and developmental needs, ages infant to 21. CedarCrestCenter.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Already this year, five states have raised the minimum wage. In his speech last week, President Obama vowed to make reducing income inequality a primary focus of his final years in office. He called on Congress to raise the federal